This is the Sounds of Healing, interviews and music for you to reflect on, be rejuvenated by, and possibly even put you on a path of reconciliation. Who knows what you just might walk away with? I'm Alvinette Downing, and I hope to put some sunshine in your life and remind you of just how good it is to be alive. Brought to you by Radio St. Pete and the Al Downing Tampa Bay Jazz Association. Well, today I have my BFF, my very best friend forever. This woman I have known since over 60 years, right? Since I was 10 years old, and we were fourth grade classmates. And I am talking about Dr. Linda Mizell. Welcome to the show, Dr. Mizell.
Thank you. Joy to be here.
Good. I'm so glad you are here. Well, Linda has done a lot of things beyond our Perkins experience here in St. Petersburg. She is an educational historian and has done curriculum development, writing, and as a consultant for a lot of professional interests. Her creation of multicultural, anti-racist institutions she has done with schools, within colleges, and other organizations. So she's just got a deep breadth of knowledge and experience in this field. She also has a lot of other things, and I told her, I said, this bio that she gave me is really short compared to all the things that she's done. So I'm just going to pass this mic over to her because she's just an amazing woman. I want you to know what kind of woman she is that I've been had the blessing and to know for so many years.
I should pay you for all the PR hype.
I did pretty good, right? But it's true. It really is true.
Well, thank you for the warm introduction. And, you know, when you told me I was going to be on Sounds of Healing. And, you know, I had to think for a minute. I'm an educational historian.
Yes.
How does that tie into, you know, the theme of the show? But it didn't take long for it to kick in.
I know.
And so there are three stories that I want to tell. And part of it will be reading the words of the people who are at the center of these stories.
Absolutely. Okay. We can't wait. Okay. Audience, hold on to your seats. Here it comes.
Okay. So first is James Weldon Johnson, another son of Florida. I was known for a lot of stuff, you know, as a poet, as an author, as an activist, as a diplomat, as a Broadway playwright, as a principal.
Oh, yeah,
The long list of things, you know, too long for me to remember, you know, at my age.
Yeah, look, we're both the same age.
Without notes.
Okay.
So these are his words. Okay. He said, a group of young men in Jacksonville, Florida, arranged to celebrate Lincoln's birthday in 1900. Footnote, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, Lincoln's birthday was an enormous celebration in African-American communities because he was credited as the man who freed the slaves,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
And so he was deeply honored, and his birthday was always a celebration of Black communities. So this wasn't random. My brother, J. Rosamond Johnson, and I decided to write a song to be sung at the exercises in Jacksonville. I wrote the words, and he wrote the music. Our New York publisher made mimeographed copies for us, and the song was taught to and sung by a chorus of 500 colored school children. Shortly afterwards, my brother and I moved away from Jacksonville to New York, and the song passed out of our minds. But the school children of Jacksonville kept singing it. They went off to other schools and sang it. They became teachers and taught it to other children. Within 20 years, it was being sung all over the South and in some other parts of the country. Today, the song, popularly known as the Negro National Anthem, and in our contemporary times as the Black National Anthem, is quite generally used. The lines of this song repay me in an elation, almost of exquisite anguish, whenever I hear them sung by Negro children. And that's such a perfect description of the song and what it evokes for us collectively.
Right.
Elation and an almost exquisite anguish, because it talks about the struggles and the hopes and the joy and the resistance and all of those things. Okay. Want to note that he doesn't talk about this, but it was, if not illegal, definitely impolitic and definitely risky for Black people to sing that song in the presence of white people.
Is that right?
And so even though it was sang all over the South in African-American schools, they had to do it on the down low. And there's a story about that in Maya Angelou's first memoir, I Know How the Caged Bird Sings. And if you if you've read that memoir, I'm sure you're, I think it was one of the most stunning, deeply felt chapters in the book. But it was about Maya's graduation, and this was in the mid-40s, her graduation from high school, from an all-Black school. You know, at that time, all the Black schools in the South
segregated.
Were all Black because they were segregated. So they were all Black or they were all white.
Okay.
Though, historical footnote that I won't turn into one of my long stories,
okay.
there actually are some notable exceptions to that, but that's a story for another day.
Okay. All right. Well, continue. This is really
interesting. So at Maya's graduation, everybody's excited because graduations in African-American communities
were huge things, whether
you even knew anybody who went to the school. It was a community event.
Yes.
The children were all of our children.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
And another educational historian wrote about a graduation ceremony in a rural community, a tiny little rural community that attracted thousands of people from all around. So you know those weren't all parents and uncles and cousins.
That's right.
The schools were the hearts of the community. And so that's
it takes a village.
Yes, the village shows up. And that's very much what was happening at Maya School in little tiny Stamps, Arkansas. So everybody was excited. Everybody was going. You know, the kids had been practicing. You know, the valedictorian was ready. And their usual order of service, you know, was that they'd sing the national anthem. They'd recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
Okay.
And then they'd sing the Negro National Anthem and then sit down.
Okay.
So they came in all, you know, in their, you know, white dresses and suits and faces all shiny and oiled up and excited about graduation. And they sang the national anthem, they recited the pledge, and then they got the message, you know, they got the principal motion for them to all sit down, and they were kind of confused. Well, what had happened was, as we say, what had happened was that a white supervisor from the Department of Education had dropped by, okay, and they had to reshuffle the whole program for him to get in. And he made a speech that talked about all the wonderful things that they were doing and building and adding to the white school. When it got the, you know, few references to their school was about the athletes that had gone on to play college ball and how they were going to, of course, if he was reelected, that their school would get some new equipment in the domestic arts program. So they were, and then he, you know, made his little speech and then rushed off to move on to the real graduation at the white high school. And so they were all just demoralized, humiliated. You know, he had ruined graduation for them. You know, they were sitting their heads down and so forth. And then the valedictorian got up and started making his speech. And she's sitting there just going through a whole range of feelings of hatefulness and, you know, anger and even anger at him for the things that he was saying because they were ringing false because of what had just happened. And then he turned around to them, to his classmates, turned his back on the audience, turned to them, and started singing "Lift Every Voice."
Oh, wow.
And it changed the room. Wow. And she wrote, and this is just one little piece of what she said. "We were on top again, as always, again. We survived. The depths had been icy and dark, but now a bright sun spoke to our souls. I was no longer simply a member of the proud graduating class of 1940. I was a proud member of the wonderful, beautiful Negro race. Oh, Black known and unknown poets, how often have your auctioned pains sustained us? Who will compute the lonely nights made less lonely by your songs, or by the empty pots made less tragic by your tales?"
Wow. Wow. You know, you started by saying you wondered how Sounds of Healing theme could be expressed through an educational historian. You made it pretty clear exactly how that connection helps.
So my immediate response was kind of a panicked wondering. Yeah. And then when I came to myself, it was a remembering.
A remembering. How that song, you know, and we started saying that, you know, being on a path of reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. What does that song do? Okay, so that story.
Okay, second story.
That's amazing.
Second story. Okay. Fisk University, originally Fisk College. Uh-huh. And probably before that, probably Fisk Normal School or Fisk some other name.
Okay.
I forget, and I didn't have time to look it
That's
up.
That's all right. Yes. Audience, forgive me, not her, because I didn't give her any heads up. But here she is.
But ready. The incredible, iconic historical institution we now know as Fisk University.
Uh-huh.
Was founded in 1866.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this was right after the Civil War, when one of the number one agendas of African Americans, and I would say it's one of the top two.
Right.
Land was
uh-huh.
one,
uh-huh.
and education was the other. And again, I won't go off into a long story about education, but you know that's my.
I know that's your heart.
And education, African American education in Florida, of course, is at the depth of my
heart.
Of
right.
my research passion. Okay, so one thing I will note is that this thriving, this sacrificing, this struggling, and working toward immediately building institutions of learning
mm-hmm.
for children and adults, mm-hmm. but especially for children, was something that was common in every single African-American community following the Civil War. And most of our HBCUs, historically Black colleges and universities, most of them did start out as grammar schools, essentially.
Okay. Normal school, yeah.
And as these institutions began to develop, there was this tension,
mm-hmm.
Largely coming from, interestingly enough, Northern white philanthropists to make them manual training schools. Okay. There are a number of schools, though, that from their inception
mm-hmm.
and over the next decades, resisting the pressure, the lack of funding, all the various pressures against this,
mm-hmm.
insisted on these institutions being liberal arts. Following a liberal arts curriculum. And that was largely due to the influence of the AMA, the American Missionary Association, that sent missionaries south to work in schools. And part of their mission was to help start those schools, to create a cadre of African-American educators
mm-hmm.
who could take over, ownership of those schools. And, I said I wasn't going to go into, back to the music.
That's
right. Okay, so Fisk was one of those schools that from its inception was clear that their mission was liberal arts. And there was a slogan that I can't recall exactly from the AMA, where they said we're in the business of building men.
Hmm. Okay.
So FIS very quickly, by 1871, was in deep financial trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and George Leonard White, mm-hmm. okay, an AMA missionary, who was also the school treasurer and music teacher,
okay,
came up with the idea of creating an a cappella choir that would go on tour,
okay,
to raise money. And I want to call the names of the eight students who were
starting.
Who were that initial group of singers in this choir: Isaac Dickerson, Ben Holmes, Green Evans, Thomas Rutling, Ella Shepherd, Maggie Porter, Minnie Tate, Jenny Jackson, and Eliza Walker. And Ella Shepherd, by the way, went on late in later years, took over the choir. Okay, but those early years were rough,
mm-hmm.
you know, for one thing, because audiences weren't used to seeing black music, Negro music, sung by actual Negroes.
Yes.
And they weren't used to the music not being minstrel tunes.
Yeah. Okay.
And we know what minstrel tunes were, songs written by white composers that essentially made fun of Negroes, harkened back to the good old days of slavery and so forth.
Okay.
So it was, you
this
know,
was a
going,
new experience.
It was a new
experience.
And they were met with, in some cases, welcome and wonder, but in a lot of cases, with humiliation and abuse.
Okay. Yeah.
And when they performed in Cincinnati, they earned $50.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This was right around the time of the devastating 1871 Chicago fire.
Sure.
They donated every cent they had to victims of the fire.
Wow.
Okay. Then they moved on to Columbus. That was their next stop. Excuse me. And again, you know, the being out on the road was rough, not only because of the audience reactions, but because there are so many places they couldn't even get rooms.
Right.
Because African Americans traveling in 1871,
right.
you know,
yeah.
not just in the South, in the North. You
this
know,
is
I mean,
right after slavery.
So yeah. they were tired, yeah. they were hungry. Half the time they were sleeping on benches in the train station.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so they were feeling really dejected. And that's when... And I'm going to read from the words of the site, the official site itself. Mr. White, in a gesture of hope and encouragement, named them the Jubilee Singers, a biblical reference to the year of Jubilee in the book of Leviticus, chapter 25.
Okay.
And they went on, you know, eventually, you know, they made it a thing, right?
Yeah, the birth of...
And initially they were not singing, you know, he was classically trained and okay. he was training them classically. Initially they were not singing what was then called Negro spirituals. Part of it was because for these students and their families, those songs were sacred. They were not for white people. They were part of their spiritual practice, their sacred practice,
mm.
and it was a private thing.
Yes.
And eventually, you know, working with him, they decided that they wanted to share this, and so they did what sounds like almost classical arrangements of those. Now, the way we hear Negro spirituals perform now, you know, by the Fisk Jubilee Singers and
yeah.
other choirs. Okay. Okay. it's not how we sing them at home or in church, right?
Right, okay. right.
So they essentially brought that form of music to the public, okay? And it became a model for African-American schools to fund themselves all over the country.
Wow.
Well into the 20th century, our very own Gibbs High School had a choir that was founded by, I keep using the word iconic, but there's just no other way to describe some of these people. The iconic Miss O.B. McLean, English teacher at Gibbs, founded the St. Cecilia Choir. And they would earn money by singing in white venues to help buy,
some,
you know, the schools were, yeah. the all the schools, but Gibbs in particular was funded primarily by the African-American community. There was incredible resistance to having a high school curriculum for blacks, having high school period, mm-hmm. but definitely having a high school liberal arts college prep curriculum in this school. And so much of the funding had to come from the African-American community. And so the St. Cecilia Choir helped raise a lot of those funds.
I think about Miss McClellan. My dad, you know, came to Gibbs, and
that brings me to my last story.
Okay, there we go. Yeah,
your dad, again, an iconic figure, Al J. Downing. Came to Gibbs, and I want to note for listeners who aren't aware of this that Gibbs was the first, and for nearly half a century, the only high school in Southern Pinellas County that served African-American students. Your dad organized the first music program at Gibbs, initially forming a dance band and later starting a renowned marching band at the high school. And I'm reading this last paragraph coming from the book you know, about your dad and about your parents.
Exactly.
Prior to 1942, there were no instrumental music programs in Florida's segregated black schools. As a result, Florida's black colleges, the four black colleges, had no feeder programs for the development of bands. And your father, along with band leaders from around, black band leaders from around the state, and two faculty members from FAMU, then FAMC, organized the Florida Association of Band Directors. Prior to its merger with the previously all-white Florida Band Association in 1966, its membership had grown to more than 30 band directors who were teaching several thousand students.
Wow.
And those are my three stories.
Wow. Well, that is something that ties everything right into how healing music is from way back when, the beginning of Lift Every Our Negro or National Anthem, Lift Every Voice, all the way to the Fisk Jubilee Singers. And I'm hoping that our audience has heard the Jubilee Singers. That is, their musicality, their techniques, their a cappella.
Their concerts are an incredible
experience. So do, if you have an opportunity to listen to them, please do. And then the roots that came here with Gibbs and starting the St. Cecilia Choir. It's amazing. I tell you what. See, this is the kind of information that I love, and Dr. Mizell, or my friend Linda, is able to bring forth and share with us. When we talk about the sounds of healing, it comes in all varieties, and just to hear our history in education is just amazing. So, Dr. Mizell, thank you so much for bringing this to us, because our audience is in love with knowing history of St. Petersburg. And since you're one of St. Petersburg's, although, let me tell you, she did graduate from Mount Holyoke College and Harvard. So, you know, yes, she is a Harvard grad, but she's also one of St. Petersburg's wonderful children. I don't know how to say that.
However you say it works for me.
I mean, one of my dear friends. So I just thank you for coming on and just sharing these stories.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my passion.
And yes, and that was the next thing I was going to say. When you talk about passion, and she's been really good. I want to tell the audience, she's been so good, because she will say that, make a long story short, and she's been struggling. She's been doing a really good job, but
no,
a short
the
story.
Opposite. I have a gift for making a short story long.
Oh, yeah, that's it. So we're doing it.
But I'm in professional mode today.
That's good. Thank you so much. So thank you so much, Linda, for being here. And we are going to close out. This has been The Sounds of Healing, and I am Alvinette Downing, hoping that our time together has left you with blessings and healings for your soul. Mm-hmm.